items on track completely. Moving on to agenda paper 6. Good morning. A new matter, IS19. Thank you. So we will move to agenda paper 6. The committee received a submission about the classification of a post-employment benefit plan applying IS19. The submitter asked whether a potential discount on plan contributions made by the sponsoring entity affects the classification of the plan. We conducted outreach on this matter, and the findings are summarized in paragraphs 9 to 14 of the agenda paper. Paragraphs 19 to 27 set out how the classification requirements in IS19 apply to the fact pattern in the submission. Based on our analysis, we think the existence of the potential discount would not in itself result in classifying the plan as a defined benefit plan. Paragraphs 28 to 29 outline our conclusion. I would like to pause here and ask whether you agree with our analysis of the requirements in IFRS standards, summarized in paragraphs 15 to 29 of our agenda paper.
Hi.
I have to admit I'm personally struggling with this one. Notion of the circumstances in which the employer is exposed to downside risk, in my view, I think requires a bit of a broader assessment of the substance of the overall arrangement. And I think about a couple scenarios where I'm a bit worried that this analysis would imply we have a defined contribution plan when it really strikes me that it's a defined benefit plan. And the two scenarios that come to mind are if you set your contribution levels at an amount where you expect future refunds, It strikes me that arrangement is exposed. The employer is exposed to downside risk because the amount of refund you're going to get in the future is dependent on future actuarial experience, investment return, et cetera. Setting a contribution level up here as opposed to down here shouldn't really change, in my mind, the outcome of the classification of the plan. And so the other example that comes to mind is an arrangement where you have a benefit formula that defines benefits, but it's capped based on a certain contribution level. And the employer can perhaps choose to contribute between, you know, a low level of X and a high level of Y, and depending on the future performance of the fund, those contributions can adjust somewhere within that band. So if I agree to set the contributions at 10, and then depending on performance, I have to go up to the top end of the band, potentially retrospectively top up my past contributions to say 15, which was the top end of the band. That's seems to me to be a defined benefit arrangement. If instead I start out with setting my contributions at 15, but I can get money back depending on performance of the underlying fund and actuarial experience, this paper seems to imply to me that that's a defined contribution plan, but the economic substance of those two arrangements strikes me as identical. And even if I set the contributions at 15, if I'm expecting money back, it strikes me that the substance of that overall arrangement is exposing me to downside risk. And that's that aspect of this paper is causing me to really struggle with the outcome. Where it seems to me that you could have an arrangement that, in the grand scheme of things, is economically identical, but just where you decide to set your contribution level will then define whether you fall to a DC classification or a DB classification. But the economic substance is the same.
Paul?
Yes, I agree with staff's analysis and conclusion. I have only a small suggestion. I would refer BC 30 in the text of the agenda decision because it provides a lot of clarity to this specific question. It seems the cornerstone to answer the question, and therefore I would like to see that in the wording of the agenda decision.
Unlike Guy, I'm troubled by the staff's analysis. Staff is correct. The standard does refer to downside risk, but it also, in paragraphs 28 and 30, focuses on a principle of who in substance bears the actuarial and investment risk. And the way the staff has analyzed downside risk, those two things may not be the same for the examples that Guy raised. And I think we really should be focusing on who bears the actuarial and investment risk. Downside risk, it depends on where's your starting point. And the staff's starting point is that. So let me give you another example. To guys, let's say I set the cap at something that's extremely high, that it's remote, that would ever have to exceed that. But again, because of legal provisions, I can't. But it's very high. And there's always expected to be a discount. And that discount could be 40%, 50%, 80%. It's going to depend on how well the investments do and how long people live. So really, in substance, in that scenario, I think the employer bears the investment and actuarial risk. And I think that one should be a defined benefit plan, not a defined contribution. But the way I read the analysis, I think because it's got a cap, you'd say it's defined contribution.
Can I ask a question? Maybe I just wanted to ask a question, maybe either of Guy and Bob on this. So I think you're right, but obviously in our analysis, we talk about looking at the definition of a defined contribution plan that our view was is the way that's defined as focuses on, you know, downside risk in terms of the decision. And you're right to say, Bob, but what's the starting point? And I think in the definition, the starting point is not just that there's some cap, but it is that the entity pays contributions into a separate fund. So I think the starting point in working out upside down is that you pay contributions into a fund for a particular period. And so that's your starting point for downside. I think the other thing is that IS 19 to us in paragraphs 28 and 30 actually describe specifically how IS 19 looks at actuarial risk and investment risk. And at least those words we looked at, that the way they're described just focuses on one way, in a sense. It's not any exposure to any changes in actuarial assumptions. It's that benefits will be less than expected or that asset investment will be insufficient. So I think that's just that fed into it. And I suppose one, you know, a question I have maybe in your thinking is how you thought those words all work together, both in the context of, yeah, I mean, what's in paragraphs 28 and 30 in terms of how IS 19 defines actuarial risk and investment risk, but also picking up on Carl, maybe just the how that links into sort of the amendment that the board made in 2011 that's explained quite clearly in BC 30, and also committee's previous discussion, I think we quoted when, you know, talked about vesting conditions. So I don't know if you thought about that in your thinking or how that sort of all pieces together.
So, Petrine, my first reaction to is I'm not sure I'm in agreement with where you said your starting point is. You said your starting point is that the entity is making contributions into a separate trust. The way I read the analysis, to me, it seems like your starting point really is the entity is making fixed amount of contributions into the trust, or I shouldn't have said it that way. It's not fixed. There's a maximum amount of contributions that they're making into the trust, and I'm literally looking for a fixed amount. Your max could have great variability to it based on actuarial results and investment results. And so that's what I'm reading out of 28, saying, well, you know, when in substance the employee, what I'm taking out of 28 and 30 is the principle that when in substance the employer is bearing that variability, then it's a defined benefit plan.
But not necessarily any variability, just having paid contributions. Yeah. So I've paid 100, and then the only thing that can happen after that is that I might get an amount back.
Can I ask a question? Because what Bob and Guy seem to be asking is it not downside risk if I've set an amount, which is a high amount?
Have you paid it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And I might get back 100, or I might only get back 5. Is that not a form of downside risk because I'm only getting back 5 when I had hoped I'd get back 100? I think that's the basic question they're asking. So how does that fit in with your analysis of this idea of downside risk? I think that's what they're asking. And I'm asking you innocently because I don't know how to answer it.
I think it's a central part.
It's not a trap.
And I'll start, and if other committee members, and I'll ask it, you know, Peter or Javid to come in. So I suppose how you read that, as I say, so let me try and explain, and if I don't answer, please say, is that, you know, the actual definition of defined contribution says it's a plan under which an entity pays fixed contributions into a fund and will have no legal or constructive obligation to pay further contributions. So I've paid 100. And I have no legal or constructive obligation to pay anything further. I'll never, under any scenario, have to pay anything more than the 100 in relation to...
Because the risk they're looking at is receiving back less, that's different to having to pay back more. That's the simple answer to the question.
Exactly. And that just feeds through in terms of how IAS 19 appears to describe actuarial and investment risk, which isn't just... any exposure to changes in actuarial assumptions or investment you get, but it seems to be only, you know, anything that means the benefits could be more than what you paid, or the investment returns possibly could be less
when
than
you
what
might
you
have
had
to pay in more,
yes,
as opposed to you might have a risk of receiving less. Yeah. You're distinguishing between those two.
And is very important in this
That helps me understand the discussion we're having. Okay, Guy, did you want to come in again?
Yeah, I just I almost lost my cup.
Who knew IAS 19 could be so exciting?
You have a claw for that?
Not needed.
My worry with that sort of view of what constitutes downside risk is it's just open to structural abuse. Because if you take the one of the examples I was thinking about there, an arrangement that says, hey, you have to contribute anywhere between $10 and $15. If you choose to contribute 10, depending on performance of the fund, you might have to top that up retrospectively to 15. We would say that's a defined benefit plan because you're exposed to actuarial and investment risk. If I start out by saying, okay, I'll put in the 15 and I'll get my, you know, I'll get back what I get back. The substance of that arrangement in my mind is no different. It's just the classification then is driven by where I choose to set my contribution level. And I really, really struggle with that being the deciding factor on what's a DC plan versus a DB plan. I think in substance, the employer does have downside risk exposure, regardless of whether they set it at 10 or 15.
All right. Thank you. Mikhail.
just to reflect on the last thing there, I think that it would be not very attractive to the company to account for the 15, because of course, if we would be up here, we would have a cost in the books every year on the 15, and then we hope that we get something back. So I think that it would more probably be the expected payment that you should do. And in that case, I think that this is a more principle-based conclusion. And I was very happy to see this, that we come up with this conclusion, because I think that we often more read it more rule-based. So I'm very supportive of this conclusion and decision.
Thank you. Jim.
All right. I share the same concerns Guy and Bob raised, and I went through almost exactly the same thought process. However, the way I look at it is that when we say a potential discount, do we have the kind of level of frequency in mind? I understand Katrina said it's not about setting a higher bar, and the company could intentionally put it at 15. And they will pay 15 in the earlier years. And if 10 years down the road, they get a discount, a potential discount, because of all these things, all this logic will be good. This is very solid. But every other year, they will pay 15 and 10, 15 and 5. That will effectively change the fixed amount of obligation by the entity. So if we say that, just following the staff's logic, is in very infrequent or something like that, with rare occasion, a potential discount, I think I will support the logic and the conclusion. We just want to avoid this abuse of structural design. We set the bar, they will pay 15, maybe occasionally 5 out of 10 years, and they will get a potential discount or many potential discounts down the road. That will be abused. But a couple of times, maybe once, every 10 years, it should be solid. So I think that's the way I look at it. If we make this in the infrequent rear potential discount, I agree with this logic, and we just need to tell them don't try to make it a game. Set the high bar, and they don't need, obviously, if they set the bar high, they have no downside risk. They will occasionally pay the 15. And then always, most of the years, lower. That will change the nature of this plan to be a different benefit ones. But I think just try to avoid this potential structural abuse of this logic.
Okay. Bertrand.
I agree with the staff analysis. And I think to echo what Patrina explains, and to answer to Guy, to Bob, and to Jim in this matter, I would say that the important part of the paragraph is really what comes after the hand. That is, the entity is not eligible to any further cash contribution. It strikes me a bit that you think an entity may accept to pay more on a yearly basis just to structure a plan to become a defined contribution plan. There are cash management processes in entities, and honestly, you don't pay 15 if you just need to pay 10. And nobody would accept you pay 15 just to structure and to achieve an accounting, at least in our company. And probably in most company I can know of. And it is on a matter that relates to benefits for employees. So it's something that is really managed within entity, that for sure. The problem, there is still a problem to structure, but it's not this one. I think without negating the outcome of the agenda, the outcome of the agenda decision, it could be achieved via an addendum to the words. I liked a lot the end of paragraph 29, because I think it's where there might be a risk of structure. of structuring things. It's on those additional potential future contributions. So what you're saying is that if there is no additional future contribution to be paid on past or current service costs, then you're fine. You're not fine, sorry. It's a defined benefit. But if you pay future contribution for future service costs, then effectively you're fine. It's a defined contribution. But you're pointing out a limit to that is if effectively an entity would structure things such as the future contributions are set to implicitly compensate without stating explicitly past and current service costs. So I would add the end of paragraph 29 into the agenda decision, into the words of the agenda decision, to really explicitly state that we don't have that in mind to be a defined contribution plan. But for the rest, I'm not worried because it conflicts with the way cash is managed or employee benefits are managed within entities.
So I have some of the same concerns that Guy and Bob and Jim laid out. I also was going to suggest adding, I was thinking all of paragraph 29, but perhaps it can be shortened a little bit because I think to me that was one of the more critical parts of the staff paper. I also think a reference to paragraph 28 of IS 19, Petrina, that you were referring to, but I think the last sentence is where my head was in terms of, it says, in consequence, actuarial risk and investment risk fall in substance to the employee. Yeah. That to me is the critical point, and I think that's the point that you're making, Bob, that you made, Bertrand, in terms of let's make sure that whatever is in the future is not implicitly making up for investment or actuarial risk that is inherent. And I could see that a company, in order to keep the balances off their books, could structure something in such a way that I have to pay a little more cash now, but I don't have the liabilities on my books. So I do think it's important to focus on that concept because to me that's the critical part of the analysis of what's defined benefit and what's defined contribution. And I think adding paragraph 29 or parts of it to the tentative agenda decision, but also referring to that piece of paragraph 28 of IS 19, to me that's the critical point in the assessment.
Okay, thank you. Gary.
Thank you. I actually hate to follow Bonnie because you largely said exactly what I was going to say. Then I said, Sherry talks as the flow of the room seems to be coming out in support of the agenda decision. But I think just kind of step back. I think you always have a DB plan. And the question is, if you meet some rigid criteria, you might be able to get a DC plan out of it. But one of those criteria is exactly what Bonnie said, is the employer has no investment or actuarial risk. Whatever goes in the fund, that's the number. Fixed could be an absolute amount, but usually it's probably expressed as a percent of pay or percent of profit or something. But it's fixed in that it's defined, you know, what it's going to be, and you've got an objective reference point. And if you want to have the plan to be tax qualified, employers cannot be giving themselves flexibilities to, you know, make decisions about what assets you contribute or discounts or refunds you get back and so on. You don't get tax qualified status in most of the, you know, Western world that I'm familiar with touching it. So I think we've got the right answer personally under the agenda decision. It says if the ratio of plan assets to plan liabilities exceeds a set level, that's under B. First of all, I have trouble. Assets always equal liabilities in defined benefit plans because you have no obligation to put more money in. You've got an obligation to hit your fixed contributions defined in the plan, nothing beyond. And if you think of the last 20 years as employers have been bailing on DB plans for DC plans, it's exactly because they don't want actuarial investment risk. The cash input, the funds still might be the same, but it's much more predictable, et cetera, in it. So I think, you know, maybe referencing paragraph 20 is exactly right, but I think we got the right answer here, but that's just a bit of context. You know, I think of why DC plans are, they're hard to achieve, but once you achieve them, you have no flexibility other than put the money in.
Mm-hmm. Bruce?
Thanks. Following Bonnie and yourself, a lot of the comments are the same. I mean, I guess I was just kind of put my hat on when I first read this. My concern was the structuring. So I kind of put my hat on and said, well, is this a great opportunity to phone up my clients and say we can structure these things out of it? To me, the biggest issue why that wouldn't worry me, and I'm in support of the agenda decision, is because at the end of the day, somewhere along the line, you would have to disclose that you've got no further obligation, that if you put all this money into the wrong assets, the employees are going to get nothing. And I think that if you're an employee and you kind of expecting to get something regardless of the performance on the assets, and now your employer turns around and says, well, actually, unlucky guys, we're not going to, it's all on your risk. That's a fundamental change in what you've offered your employees. So I think that, you know, for somebody to structure it, just to achieve that answer, when the message you're going to be giving to employees is we've taken all the risk out of our hands and put it on yours, I'm not convinced people are going to rush into that. The other thing was just in response to the way the guy and Bob have been commenting on it. I mean, the way I've always seen this is very simple. You're right, I could choose to over-contribute. So if I take the example, instead of contributing 10, I'll contribute 15 to this. At the end of the day, the big issue to me is that I do not have to make any further contribution. If the assets collapse, if the liability goes through the roof, whatever may happen, I'm not on the hook for anything else. And that kind of, to me, was how I got to the answer that we had there.
Marshall?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge with regard to pensions is that you always have a disconnect between the obligation and the assets, and in terms of timing and in terms of value development due to several reasons. My point here is if you say, okay, you end up in a DC plan and you have no legal obligation, that's pretty clear. For me, the question really means what does it mean that you have no constructive obligation? And this is this really the reality, and what kind of expectation you have raised when setting up a kind of pension plan? Yeah? And specifically, if we then discuss with the trustees about the new rate, so to say, to pay, whether for the existence of the pension plan itself, you would not say, okay, I accept that. So that element for me would be very important. That it could depend on culture, nation, or whatever, and how pension plans are used. But on the other hand, you also have to be aware that you not more or less give away a pension plan any second year, so to say, to offer a new pension plan or pension scheme. If that would be the case, I would say, okay, for sure no constructive obligation. But in general, what you do is you discuss that with your trustee, and then probably you are willing more or less to pay the higher rate. And as in general, it is quite challenging to make a differentiation between more or less assets and which relate to prior services, and then for these which relate to future services. I guess it might be harder from that perspective. So I see what Bruce meant. I mean, if we really blend that out and say, okay, we can do that whenever we like, then the agenda decision would be the right answer. But the question for me really, what does constructive mean in that regard?
Andrew?
I understand the analysis that the staff have gone through to get to what's in the agenda decision. Like some others, I worry a bit about potential structuring. And I think of it in perhaps a slightly more extreme example, that let's say I've got a DC scheme and I set my contributions at a level where there is a 0.1% chance, even in a complete downside scenario, that I would ever, ever not get a refund back because I'm paying a huge excess in. That says to me that I'm exposed to all the actuarial risk. But if I only focus on downside, well, I've already paid all the money in. So rather than the same way as Bob and Guy have articulated, I worry that you could have the potential to pay more in, claim something's a DC scheme, when in fact it isn't a DC scheme at all. in relation to do I think companies would be prepared to do that, it's very nice to hear that Bertrand's company would be very well behaved and not. I can think that some might just think it was worth a price worth paying. So I do worry about that. Like Bonnie, I like paragraph 29 in the agenda paper, and some way of building that into the agenda paper, into the agenda decision, would be quite nice. The other thing that struck me, if I take my very extreme example where I'm paying, say, 200 or 300% of the expected amount that I need to pay, paragraph 29B in the agenda paper might actually capture that, because by doing that, what I'm doing is I'm covering potential shortfalls, because in a reverse way, I'm exposed to all the actuarial risk. I'm paying more than I expect is going to be needed at the moment in order that I can cover those future losses. So perhaps 29B would help to address some of those concerns.
Thank you. Reinhardt?
I agree with much of the staff analysis in respect of the particular facts and circumstances of the case as laid out. But my comments would be very similar to what Bonnie said and what Andrew just said as well. I think it'd be very important, in my view, to make absolutely clear in the agenda decision the particular facts and circumstances, and include some of the thinking from paragraph 29, because I do concern as well. Have concerns as well of having a definitive statement that the ability to get a refund doesn't disqualify a plan from being a defined contribution. So as Bob and Guy and others have said, I think it depends on what obligations are of the employee going forward. And so I think clarifying that in the fact pattern, in the agenda decision is important. I think perhaps the way to do that is where in the agenda decision, this I think is the second last paragraph where it says, consequently, the committee concluded in the fact pattern described that, I think an additional sentence or two bringing in the concepts from paragraph 29, perhaps in the agenda paper would be helpful.
Thank you. Young Su?
I heard a lot of, discussions about structuring abuse and those things. But to me, I think the standard is very clear. The standard says DC plan has no upside risk, and upper cap is fixed. And upper cap is the amount the company usually pays. And that's very clear to me. So I'm supportive of the staff analysis conclusion. Maybe we can have some explanations like Reiner said. Maybe that helps, but I think as it is drafted, I think everybody understands what we meant. And it is not our role as a committee to prevent any structuring, any or something like that, but our role is how to read the standard correctly, appropriately. So I'm fully supportive of the staff analysis and conclusion.
Thank you. Goro.
Okay, I agree with the staff's analysis. This has this defined contribution plan. But from the financial statement user's point of view, what we want to know is that if there is any risk for an entity's liability to expand or not, depending on the type of the employee benefit plan and the investment circumstances, as well as the actuarial risk. And the contribution from employer is a kind of additional. I believe that this is an additional contribution to that by the employee in order to mitigate the shortfall risk to the employees. And I think that maximum present value of the employer's obligation is limited to the present value of the future cash outflow, given that current contribution to continue forever. From employees' point of view, the discount is not like downside risk, but because it is more than offset, compensated by the good performance of the investment portfolio. So that I think that this plan is quite attractive for employees and employers. This is clearly more attractive than pure DC plan, defined contribution plan to employee, while that this is more attractive than DB plan from the employer's point of view. You know, that the DB plan has proven to be so onerous to employers. So I expect that this type of pension plan, which the risks are burdened by, that the employees and employers would increase in the future. And from the financial statement user's point of view, again, that the agent decision in the last one, the joint operation, the disclosure is a key. So that we want to know what scheme of the pension plan, as well as the possible risk or maximum risk to the employers. So that if the agenda decision could add some reference to the possible disclosure, given the current standards, that would be very helpful to the users as well.
Tony.
I share some of the concerns that some others have raised about the agenda decision as it stands. I think I've always thought about a defined benefit plan as being something that exposes the employer to actuarial and investment risk. I understand the logic that the staff has set out in the paper about why the focus is on downside risk specifically, but I guess I just worry a little bit that we're looking at a fairly narrow view of what's fixed in terms of contributions, because is it fixed if you can get some of it back? And a fairly narrow view of what downside risk is, I think, for the same reasons that Guy and Bob explained. And so I stopped and I thought, well, okay, what is it that you end up losing if you move from defined benefit accounting to defined contribution accounting? And I think quite a lot of what Goro just had to say is relevant, because there's quite a significant loss of information about assets and liabilities and assumptions made and what might happen in the future if you end up with defined contribution accounting. So I think I am nervous that the agenda decision looks at a very narrow fact pattern and perhaps takes a narrow view of fixed and downside risk. But I do wonder if some of the ideas that Bonnie had or Andrew had would help to address that and say what you need to do is you need to look at it maybe a little bit more broadly than the agenda decision does at the moment, and maybe take into account some of the things that other people have talked about in making the decision. And so I'd be interested to see what this agenda decision would look like with some of the suggestions that have been made by various people that have spoken.
Chen Wu.
Yes. This is a very interesting discussion on some kind of a possible abuse structure opportunities of the classification of DC plan or DB plan. So, you know, literally, it looks okay. The interpretation is right. However, would you like to amend IS-19 on this issue? You know, if you'd like to consider the board to improve their current requirements, then I'd like to hear your opinion on that. Would you like to talk for it?
I'm happy to respond since I spoke last. And I don't think that there is a broader issue coming out of this question. My view needs to be fixed in IS-19. I think what we have here is quite a narrow set of circumstances. Mm-hmm. My concern, as I just said, is that I think we've maybe narrowed it a little bit too far in the thinking, and that there is a way of addressing it through an agenda decision.
Right. Unfortunately, there are not so many. And entities are using this kind of practice, but, you know, based on outreach here. Only one, maybe somewhere in Netherlands in case. But if after this agenda decision, might be people are knowing some kind of possibility about the kind of a structure designing, So I think, you know, maybe the problem will be getting maybe worse rather than just, you know, we expect him now. So maybe in future, if you'd like to have some kind of amendment of the IS-19, then maybe we can ask, they can report the decision to the board.
Okay. Just about amending 19, and Chungwu got me to think of something. Look at paragraph 12 of the staff paper. It said, these fact patterns are not common. So you start wondering, does it kind of meet the cost-benefit test to reopen up pension? You're going to reopen up pension accounting if you go into it. And because I think one of the design intents of DC plan, among other things, employees have accounts. I mean, they know how much has been contributed to their account, and the account is funded. Mm-hmm. If the account is not funded, but it's sort of in a general pot, you know, you start questioning, is it even a DC plan? It's probably a DB plan. And the examples here, there's three countries where they might exist. I'm actually familiar with two of them from prior life, and they were DB plans. Is not just the attorneys, the actuaries, and the corporate, I believe they're DB plans again, because one of the fundamental, maybe not always universally required, but to my knowledge it is these are employee accounts and they're funded, 2% of your pay or something, or the pot, you know, gets 5% of profit, and then your pro rata pay or your pro rata share of the fund gets its share, but it's all defined and fixed. So employees, they're not protecting the downside, but they expect the upside, and the inverse is true for the sponsor. You mean they don't want the downside, but if you're avoiding the downside, you give up the upside. That's how these things work. It really is as simple as that. So I just can't imagine the fact pattern is so broad that's in there. Maybe it is, you know, I only know what you know, but I wouldn't want to reopen up 19 for something that the input, you know, from around the world says it's just not that common.
Okay, which is a good segue into the question that we need to ask, question two, which is whether the committee agrees with the staff's recommendation not to add the matter to the standard setting agenda. If I could get a show of hands, please. I think that's 13.
14.
We've got those
hands. I think, Guy, you... Yeah, oh, sorry.
I don't think we need standard setting. Okay. That's the question.
Okay, now the trickier question is obviously the word tentative agenda decision, which I'll hand over to maybe Katrina to comment on what she heard and what she might suggest.
Yeah.
If I'm allowed to, I might ask you a question that I wouldn't mind you talking about.
Yeah.
It struck me when I read the, not being a IS-19 person at all, but it struck me when I read the proposed wording in the tentative agenda decision that the words that we've got in the second to last paragraph on page 12 are a little bit unusual compared to what we might usually use. So the fact that we say that the fact pattern described the existence of the potential discount would not in isolation preclude classifying the plan as a defined contribution plan. If I put my old hat back on, that sounds like you're not going to prevent me doing it, but I'm not necessarily going to end up there. So I was just interested in the choice of words. It sounds very like an option.
Yeah, and maybe that's not, because another way we could word this is better, and I'll throw that out now, and then I'll walk through anything else I heard so you have time to mull it over, because you could say even actually we've just from a strictly wording perspective, almost we haven't been consistent. Actually, in that, on the first page of the agenda decision, in the middle of page 11, at the minute we said the request asked whether the existence results in a defined benefit plan. So there is a different way we could word this if it was viewed as better, almost as a response to that. This is assuming the committee agreed, by the way, and we agree with other changes that it could say would not in itself or in isolation result in classifying the plan as a defined benefit plan. So it could just be worded the other way if that was, you know, felt to be, to have sort of as a better conversation.
And other things based on the conversation?
So other things based on the conversation that I heard, and I'll look across at Javed and Peter because they can tell me if they disagree with sort of thoughts around this. So I think we had a lot of commentary about what's in paragraph B29 of the paper, first of all. And I think that we tried to cover that at the minute, but I think we can enhance it maybe. So right at the top of page 12, the second page of the agenda decision, we had the words accordingly to meet the definition. An entity must not be obliged to pay further contributions, blah, 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 under any circumstance. And that was us trying to capture that in shorthand. I think what I heard, though, is maybe some of the examples in paragraph 29 would be useful. So I could see that we could include, you know, one or both maybe of the examples that's in paragraph 29 there after that to kind of supplement that statement. So we put
what
in.
What are you going to say, Petrina?
Sorry?
What are you going to say about under in any circumstances?
So we wouldn't change those words. We'd keep the under any circumstance, but we'd add in then a kind of for example, picking up, say, at least maybe what's in 29B of the paper as an example to really emphasise that, to say, look, if you could possibly have to pay anything in the future related to past service, then.
Well, I have one example where you possibly could. Is if the employer sponsor, if the trustees happen to be executives of the employer and you had malfeasance in the administration of the assets and so on, or you just made poor investment choices that would not be mainstream, where that either where that's your constructive obligation or you're sued by the beneficiaries, there's circumstances. So I really hate these extreme, like under any circumstances, there's a case you could be educated to put money in.
So I think you're saying, Gary, that almost the opposite of some of the other comments you felt how
you worded it. I think it's under ordinary circumstances, according to the normal operations of the plan. I think that's fine, but to say never, ever, ever, I guess that you could potentially lose, you know, when if you mismanage the fund's assets, for example.
Okay, so maybe we need to just, and I won't talk off the fly, we need to think about the under any circumstance for that reason then, but we'd have similar words and maybe based on the comments build and at least the example from maybe 29B in there. We could also say, by the way, if it's helpful, just in that sentence to Bob's point about where is the starting point when you're thinking about downside risk, something as simple as saying, accordingly, having paid contributions into the fund. You know, so it says what the starting point is, which is only picking up on the definition. I heard commentary quite a lot about what is said in paragraphs 28 and 30 of IS 19 about the, you know, actuarial risk and investment risk fall in substance on the employee or in substance on the employer. I think we tried to capture that, or at least we have captured that in bullet B on the second page of the agenda decision, but maybe we should be more factual. I just have minor changes I maybe picked up to say we keep the first sentence as is. It makes that clear. But we could have the second sentence just be more factual and say paragraphs 28 and 30 describe actuarial risk as the risk that benefits blah, 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 and it describes investment risk as blah, blah, blah. And then that very much sticks to the words in those paragraphs, and it, I think, might be helpful to some of the commentary said. So I'd hope with those two we're kind of picking up, particularly Bonnie's comments about what's in paragraphs 28 and 30, but also picking up some of the extra, caveats or scenarios that where we think you wouldn't get to DC accounting if we add in the extra example. We have the commentary where we could change that conclusion as we described to focus the other way around, would not in isolation result in a defined benefit plan. And I also picked up from Gauru that perhaps, like we've done in some other agenda decisions, we could put in a disclosure piece around judgment in deciding whether it's DC or DB as a disclosure under the words of IS1 to say an entity would consider whether it needs to disclose that, you know, based on if that judgment were the words in IS1 about if that judgment formed part of the most significant judgments that it had made on its financial statements. That's what I heard. I had one other thing that, based on the discussion, by the way, came into my mind, but nobody's raised. And I actually wondered, it was us thinking about how IS 19 describes actuarial risk and investment risk. And actually, I wonder whether the exact wording of our fact pattern is not is not helpful in that. In fact, pattern in bullet B, so I'm on page 11, bullet B, it actually says any discount might be affected by actuarial risk and investment risk. And I think actually based on how IAS 19 describes those words, that's not strictly correct. And that should actually say affected by something like actuarial assumptions or investment returns. So that's just to get to make sure we're not being inconsistent in the wording, that we're using the same word to mean slightly different things.
Can I maybe just make sure I understand the direction of those changes?
Mm-hmm.
I guess based on my comments, I would have liked to have thought that assessing whether the employer has downside risk, you know, requires an assessment of the substance of the arrangement. Mm-hmm. And so even in a circumstance, if I stick with my 10 and 15 example where I set my, you know, contributions, I chose to contribute at the top end, you know, are we still enabling a conclusion here that in substance the employer is still absorbing downside risk even though they set the contribution at the top end of that band? Or are we precluding that? I would like to think that I could still say in substance I'm bearing the downside risk there. But I'm not clear whether the agenda decision is going to go that far or not based on those.
And so just to clarify, in your example, the employer, by the way, not just the employee necessarily, as itself decided, as part of the negotiations with the fund and the trustees and the employees, it's agreed that it's going to pay 15. And that's a
I think the
and it's
the,
paid 15, and that means that in the employees and the trustees signing up to that, they agree that under, I won't use under any circumstance, but having paid 15, that's all the employer will ever pay, and regardless of what happens to the investments or. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He'll never have to pay anything more.
But the expectation is they'll get some back, is I think what.
Yeah, but there's an expectation they might get something.
Well, I can think of a ton of different fact patterns here, but the fact pattern that I was describing earlier was a fact pattern where the employer had discretion in contributing anywhere between 10 and 15. But if they chose to contribute at the top end all the time, application of sort of a strict reading of this would suggest, well, that could potentially be a DC plan. But just because they chose to contribute at the top end instead of the bottom end and face the exposure to have to contribute more, now they've contributed at the top and they could get some back. The substance of that is they're still, at least in my personal thinking, they are bearing the same risks. They have the downside risk within that band.
I'll just comment first of all, and then I'll hand over to Peter to say, the facts you describe are not the facts in our fact pattern, which says pays fixed annual contributions to the plan. So at least your fact pattern is not covered in this fact pattern, and our conclusion here is worded as in the fact pattern described in the request.
Because I've got a choice between 10 and 15.
Yeah, but I'll just hand over to Peter and I.
I was going to make the same point, and I've been nervous because several people have made comments that have suggested some level of discretion. I think the whole essence here, although there's maybe some uncertainty about exactly what fixed means, the point is there's an obligation to pay fixed contributions. It's not a you choose your contributions.
Yeah.
And the whole point about DC is that the funding and the build-up of the obligation are completely aligned, whereas in DP, DB, there can be misalignments. And I think if you introduce any discretion in how the in the pattern of funding, then it's clearly not going to be DC.
But can I just? I agree with Peter, but I don't get that reading this, because if I look at the penultimate paragraph, the existence of a potential discount would not preclude classifying. Mm-hmm. And I know you're turning it around, but remember, yes, we start with fixed, but this isn't necessarily fixed because there is a discount. So this is variable. So let me lead you down a path, right?
Can I just point out one thing and then you can lead me down a path? Okay, go ahead.
Let me just lead you down, right? if we were to have a plan that the contributions were all variable, we would say defined benefit plan,
If I added a cap to the amount that I have to contribute, I don't think that should change the conclusion that that should be still a defined benefit plan. Mm-hmm. If I say, okay, now I've got a cap, and when that's supposed to be the amount I'm supposed to contribute, but I always get a discount, and that discount is always expected to be, not always, that discount is at start expected to be 50%, but it'll vary based on how my investments have done in the past, how my experience has done in the past. That's exactly the same as that one I just described before. So a to my mind, a discount can cause a plan to be a defined benefit plan. And that's not what I'm getting out of here.
So only to say that if you thought you agreed with what Peter said, what I wanted to point out is that that paragraph with the consequently, Bob, I think importantly says, in the fact pattern described in the request, and in the facts we described, it says the entity has an obligation to pay fixed.
But you don't know in the fact pattern that we've gotten this request how much that discount is. We don't know anything about that discount. That discount could be just what I just described. In real life, I probably isn't. But it could be the one that I just described of I got a cap and I'm going to always have a discount from the very start. And that discount varies based on investment results and experience.
But the important thing is not the discount in itself and the variability it generates in the cash contribution. The important part is really what comes after the hand in the paragraph within IS 19, i.e. the entity is not making any additional contribution to catch up for an insufficient funding on prior or current
Know that
contributions.
We don't know that because the discount could be decreasing in the future to make up for the bad experience in the past.
Can I just be blunt? So my understanding of what's being proposed in this agenda decision, and look, tell me if I'm telling lies, but this is my understanding, because I think it's fair to say yes or no to these guys. If I've set my plan up for whatever reasons, it might be complete fantasy, but for whatever reasons, I have set my plan up so I've agreed that I will pay a fixed amount, which is an enormous amount, with the expectation that there will be a refund and that refund will vary. I think this would say that this does meet the definition of a defined contribution plan. I think that's a straight answer to the question that Guy and
Guy's
Bob
example,
are asking.
I've agreed to pay 15. I think I'll, I will never have to pay more than I expect or whatever I'll get back, then this is saying. That's a defined contribution.
I think that is what's being said.
In the words of what your conclusion would be, that the existence of the fact that you could get something back from the 15 that's being paid would not in itself result in a defined.
On a possible fix.
Well, I don't know whether we're looking for a fix or not, or whether what people think the words say.
I'm just listening to the various different views, and I'm wondering if there is something that we could do to the agenda decision which would deal with some of the concerns. And I think that a number of us have got concerns of what actually is downside risk, because I see downside risk as being something which is more than just the potential to put more money in. There's something else in there. And I wondered whether if we said something like the committee noted that there are circumstances in which an employer's downside risk is not limited to a requirement to pay additional contributions to a plan, would then deal with that concern, because what that's saying is that it's not just because you might have to put more cash in, there are other circumstances in which you may have that exposure. And to me, if that were included in the agenda decision, it would deal with the concern I've got.
That will deal with your concern. I think it's different to the analysis in the paper, as I understand
I'm different to what we
think. I'm very concerned.
And then of a defined contribution.
Yeah, I'm worried with this, that someone that has a scheme where they could get a refund and in substance they're exposed to the risk would look at this and say, this gives me the clear. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that bothers me.
So, Andrew, only to explain, and to be clear about what we're saying then and what we're not is, the scenario that what we're saying is it's Guy's plan. I, as an employer, and everybody's agreed, I have an obligation to pay 15, and I've paid 15. I could absolutely get some refund back on that in the future, depending on a particular calculation, but I can never be expected to pay more. So what we're saying in that situation is...
We'll never pay more, sorry.
Sorry, thank you. So if I've paid that 15, I've credited cash, I've debited my expense with 15, in terms of information, I have no more obligation. And so that's going to end up being a defined contribution plan.
Maybe if I could respond to that. I look at paragraph 30B in IS 19, and it talks about actuarial risk being that benefits will cost more than expected. Mm-hmm. So if I pay 15 in, expecting it to cost 10, then I've got a 5 margin there. But I don't think it's as simple. To my mind, it's not as simple as saying, I just pay fixed amounts in. I think there's more to do than just saying if there's a fixed contribution.
But obviously the
Just put the words in the definition.
Yeah, I was going to say, because the definition focuses on saying the entity pays fixed contributions into the separate entity and will have no legal or constructive obligation to pay for the contributions if the plan blah, blah, blah.
Still, there's still a question about what fixed means. Mm-hmm. Because if I pay something and I get it back tomorrow, it doesn't feel very fixed to me.
Can I ask, Tony, just in your thoughts or anybody else, how you come back? I mean, how do you feel about what was written in BC 30 as the board's explanation of amendments in 2011 and also maybe in the previous agenda decision of the committee about vesting conditions? Are you comfortable with those? And maybe could you explain how in our situation you view that as different maybe from the example with the vesting conditions or the plan that's explained in BC 30 that was sort of the subject of the amendment?
I think comfortable with the vesting conditions in the sense that the vesting condition makes the arrangement executory. And if the employee doesn't deliver what the employee has to deliver, then that seems to me to be different to the situation that we're looking at here. I don't know if Guy or Bob would say the same thing, but that's where I saw there being a difference between the two.
But it's still a scenario where I might have paid 15 and I might get something back depending on vesting conditions. But I've still said in that situation, because I've paid 15 and I'll...
So the obligation is to pay a fixed amount in exchange for the employee's service. If the employee doesn't deliver the service, then I don't have to make the payment. And that seems to me to be different to getting some money back because of the performance of the investment.
I'm going to ask Gary and Bonnie for their comments, and then I'm going to see where we land, given the suggestions that Petrina made to the wording. And to
we might, I don't know, maybe we're belaboring some of these points, but to my way of thinking, a refund is very different than a reduced contribution. Mm. They're not the same thing. In terms of I pay 10, next year I get back 5, I'm net 5, that's different than, might be the same result, but when you make the contribution, that goes into employee accounts. That's the employee's money. They might not be able to withdraw it until they leave, but that's their money. And there's you don't reach in and take it back once you've given it to them. Now, that you might, if you put too much in, maybe there's opportunity for reduced contributions in the future. I think that's a different thing. But a reduced future contribution is entirely different from a refund. If you have a refund, it's a DB plan, I think, under any circumstance. If you've got the ability to go in. And the other thing, if you have the ability to go in, and certainly in 4 or 5 countries I'm familiar with, it's no longer a tax-qualified plan. That contribution is taxable income to the employee. You just give money is what you've done. I mean, I think that we're come up with a lot of constructs around here that, yes, there's some accounting ramifications. I just don't think they, for the most part, they exist in practice. Because you just can't – the employee – you can't take money back from the employee once given. It's really that simple. Maybe – you can reduce contributions for next year's annual contribution. That's an entirely different issue, I think. But there is, I just cannot envision or just reaching in and taking money back that you once given. You will not have a tax-qualified plan.
Bonnie?
I think where I struggle with is in substance, which is what paragraph 28 of IS 19 says, that if that amount that is paid by the employer varies based on investment and actuarial risk, I don't see how that can be a defined contribution plan. That's the simple way that I've been looking at it. Because in page 15 of 19, where it's describing the issue, it says the discount is calculated based on strict retrospective conditions, including elements that are affected by economic, actuarial, investment risks related to the pension fund. So the net amount that is paid by the employer is impacted in substance by the investment in the actuary risk. How can that be a defined contribution plan?
Only so, I know we've talked about it enough, but only to say in paragraph 28 and 30, the way IAS 19 defines actuarial risk and investment risk is just in the situation where benefits will cost more than expected or an asset's investments will be insufficient. So it actually,
if the net amount is different, then how does it not cost more?
But I think,
but it's because you've paid 15.
Yeah, I know, but your net cost, how can you disregard the fact, the substance of the net amount that is paid is different?
I've paid 15. I might get something back, but I've paid.
No, that's the variability.
It's variability, no.
The second sentence of BC 30 simply clarifies.
This was a minute.
Straightforward.
Yeah. So I think there's strong differences of opinion on what 19 should say versus what it does say.
I think it's going back to Chung-Woo's question.
So let me be fair here. So we've heard the proposed adjustments that Petrina suggesting that we make to the agenda decision to try and address at least some of the points that have been raised in the discussion. It does boil down to, though, an agenda decision which focuses on the direction of the payments based on what the words in the standard are and what the analysis in the staff paper is. Some people don't like that, but I think that's where we are. And so given that, can I get a show of hands for who supports the agenda decision with the adjustments that Petrina had proposed?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Okay. Let's see what the world says. Good discussion.
Quite disturbing.
Which takes us to the close of today of the meeting. So thank you very much, everybody. Finished on a sort of robust note, I think. Thank you very much.